It's Friday, but what's the headline today on The World? I'm Marco Werman. The day started out with President Trump in the UK downplaying the Russia meddling story.
Anything you do, it's always going to be, oh, Russia. He loves Russia. I love the United States, but I love getting along with Russia and China and other countries.
But then his own Justice Department drops a bombshell. 12 Russian intelligence officers indicted for interfering in the 2016 presidential race here in the U.S.
According to the allegations in the indictment, the defendants worked for two units of the main intelligence directorate of the Russian general staff, known as the GRU.
All while Trump gets ready to meet with Russia's Vladimir Putin on Monday. We'll get into all of that just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Let's get right to the big news this afternoon on the Russia meddling investigation. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein announced the indictment of 12 Russian intelligence officers as part of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation.
According to the allegations in the indictment, the defendants worked for two units of the main intelligence directorate of the Russian general staff, known as the GRU. The units engaged in active cyber operations to interfere in the 2016 presidential election.
Mueller's investigation is also looking at possible ties between Russia and the Trump campaign, but Rosenstein was careful to make this point today.
There's no allegation in this indictment that any American citizen committed a crime. There's no allegation that the conspiracy changed the vote count or affected any election result.
Noah Shachtman is editor-in-chief at The Daily Beast. So what did we learn from Rob Rosenstein and the DOJ today?
Yeah, we learned something really significant. We learned that the hacking of the Democratic National Committee and the attack on the American election was a Russian intelligence operation. This wasn't some rogue hackers in St. Petersburg. This wasn't Russian-inspired. This wasn't people, you know, kind of loyal to Putin. This was an attack by Russia's main military intelligence agency, the GRU. Now, for months, Putin has been telling Trump that the Kremlin had nothing to do with the attack on the American election. Now we know those assurances to be bogus.
So the Department of Justice is calling these new indictments, but we've also heard before some of these fake personas that the Russians created online, Guccifer and DC leaks. So what exactly is new here?
Yeah, what's new here is that these have been specifically tied to the GRU, the military intelligence arm of Russia. That's a very big deal. And it also names specific officers in the GRU as the people behind the hacks. Moreover, it names the people who created some of the hacking tools used to break in to the DNC and elsewhere.
Where in the world are these military intelligence officers and what will happen to them?
Well, in the short term, nothing's going to happen to these guys. But it does raise the question of whether Trump will ask Putin to extradite these people to America to face justice.
So what do you make about the timing of these indictments, Noah?
It's awfully inconvenient for Trump. I don't know if that was deliberate on the DOJ's part or not.
Inconvenient because he's meeting with Putin on Monday in Helsinki.
Correct.
So another thing we learned today was that these Russian intelligence officers were able to steal information about 500,000 voters by hacking into a state election board's website. Is this the first time we're hearing about a successful intrusion as part of this overall investigation into Russian hacking?
It looks like it was the Illinois State Board of Election. And there has been some talk of this before, but it really does highlight that these guys were interested in more than just spreading propaganda, that they were really interested in seeing lots of different ways in which they could influence the election. It's not clear exactly how that voter information was used, if at all, but it's yet another sign of the complexity of the operations.
Yeah, so let me take that one step further, because one big question looming as the special counsel's probe continues has been whether Russian interference had any impact on the election result. Did we learn anything new on that front today?
Not necessarily, but I, look, I think at this point you would have to be willfully naive to think none of this stuff had any impact whatsoever. I mean, the idea that these leaks, which dominated day after day after day after day of news coverage, just had no impact whatsoever, I just find laughable. The idea that these Facebook ads created by the Russians, which reached millions and millions and millions of voters, had no impact on the election is just laughable. The idea that all these fake news stories meant to sow division in the country that reached millions and millions of people had nothing to do with the election. It had no impact whatsoever. That's laughable too. And collectively, you know, the idea that none of this mattered at all, I think, is just a joke.
Noah Shachtman with The Daily Beast. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Before the big news dropped in Washington, all the attention was on President Trump's visit to the UK, you know, our special ally across the pond.
So I would say I give our relationship in terms of grade the highest level of special.
Trump was full of praise for British Prime Minister Theresa May at their news conference today, which was in direct contrast to his sharp criticism of May in an earlier interview when he slammed the Prime Minister's new plan for Brexit, the UK's exit from the European Union.
Well, I think the deal that she's striking is not what the people voted on. It's a much different deal than the people voted on. It was not the deal that was in the referendum.
The World's Matthew Bell is in London. So threats and charm, Matthew. How do you square that circle?
That's a tough one. You look at the what's in that Sun interview, and it seems that Donald Trump is just stepping directly into the most kind of, you know, the darkest controversy that's happening right now in British politics. And he's weighing in on one side. He seemed to be sort of taking the far right pro-Brexit, hard Brexit tack, as they call it here, and criticizing Theresa May's government. She's got a tough row to hoe here with working out the Brexit plan that the British public voted on 2 years ago. They've been working on this. We just don't know how May is going to thread the needle here negotiating with the EU and what that Brexit, what the terms of Brexit are going to look like.
So Brexit on the minds of politicians and leaders, but on the minds of people protesting in the streets, it was rather different.
It was. I mean, some people here will talk about Brexit and Trump in the same breath and say that they are part of a worrisome trend in their view that's happening now in the West, and that's just tending toward more far-right policies. But the protesters in London today definitely focused on Donald Trump. This is a real sort of a rallying beacon for all kinds of different people with many different issues. There were protesters, Marco, from all over the country that came into London. They took buses from cities as far away as Manchester. We're talking like 2-3 hours away. This morning, I went to the city of Bristol. It's about 2-hour drive west of London. Started there this morning, and I met up with a 36-year-old social worker who was heading into London pushing a homemade protest prop.
My name's Jenny Van Heerden. I've got Donald Trump in a rubbish bin with signs of Dump Trump plastered all around, made out of an orange beach ball with a nice blonde wig. And his little orange hands are sticking out, holding a mobile phone, clutching to the side of the bin.
This is the sort of garbage bin that you have in front of your house.
I had to clean it out last night. It took me. It was disgusting. And I was in there with bleach and all sorts of things, trying to get the smell out. It's disgusting. But anyway.
This isn't Jenny's first protest. She remembers taking part in the big anti-war demonstrations in London before the 2003 U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. And this visit from Donald Trump has her out in the streets again, pushing her trash can down a cobblestone street to the Bristol bus station, she explains.
I think he's like anti-humanity, and I'm pro-humanity. You know, putting children in cages, like something's going seriously wrong when you can do that to children and have them standing up in courts. And, you know, it's terrifying. And I think that the way he's behaved represents, like, it's sort of similar to what's going on in the 1930s, you know, the hatred campaigned against the Muslims, against Mexican people, and the levels of racism is just abhorrent. And we all ought to be standing up against that, in my opinion.
Jenny took the day off work today to be part of this demonstration, even though many of her friends didn't bother.
It's really hard in society now. Everyone gets bombarded with, oh, the planet's dying and all of the misery. And I think we have to be hopeful. And I think doing things like this actually makes you feel hopeful, like getting together with other people and trying to be a part of something that's galvanizing. I think that is how revolution starts, isn't it? Just people coming together and trying to make a difference.
Jenny tucked her trash can under the bus, took a seat inside, and tried to get some rest. It took nearly 3 hours to get into the center of London, where the protest was just getting started.
Come on, move it! Come on, don't delay, move it, move it, we're blocking traffic.
Stepping off the bus, Jenny Van Heerden walks into the crowd as the anti-Trump demonstration gets underway. There are tens of thousands of people converging here, but Jenny says she couldn't persuade her 13-year-old daughter to join her.
She likes it when she comes along. She's been on a few protests. When she was younger, she'd get more into it. Yeah, her friends and Snapchat are more important at the moment, I think.
So, as we heard, Matthew, Jenny was joined by thousands of others, not her daughter, but tell us what the protest was like.
There were labor unions there. I saw bakers who were calling for a strike. There were teachers. There were activists there. There were students. There were families. It was very much of a carnival type of easygoing atmosphere in the parts of the protest that I was in. You know, it reminded me of some of the marches that have happened back in the States, like the Women's March. Talked to a lot of people today, Marco, starting with Sonia Skeets. She lives in London. She's actually born in the U.S. and grew up in Australia. And she's the chief executive of a group called Freedom from Torture.
We here are holding on to the values, the shared transatlantic values that formed the basis for the peace after World War II. He's stepping away from those things, and we are here on the streets of London today and all over the rest of the country to be saying to him, don't shed those things. They are the things that made America great in the first place.
Hi, so my name's Peter. I'm from Yorkshire. I'm 56 years old, and this is the first march I've ever been on. I think it was very important just to get out and show the numbers of people that are against Trump, not against America, not against Americans. We want to show that, yeah, we like America, but this is a time to be counted and to show him that we're against what he stands for and the ways running roughshod over the world.
It's Mandy. I'm from London. My shirt says, it just makes a few points. Science is real. Black lives matter. No human is illegal. No human is illegal. So, you know, with all this wall, his talk of the wall and separating people, making divisions. Time for him to go.
Jem, J-E-M. I'm from Ruislip. I'm 17. My sign says, keep your tiny hands off our rights. Well, Trump's obviously a symbol of regression for not only America, but the whole world, because his policies tend to show signs of racism, sexism, misogyny, and all sorts of things that tend to diminish human rights. We're against that, so we want him to keep his tiny hands off our rights.
Whole host of critiques there. Matthew Bell, Trump does have his supporters in the UK, as we heard from you yesterday. Were there any counter demonstrations today?
There were some people who call themselves Trump supporters, Marco, though overall the atmosphere was overwhelmingly anti-Trump. And as I said, it was quite an easygoing protest, though very large, many tens of thousands of people. The organizers say that it was 250,000 people in the streets today.
The world's Matthew Bell in London. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
We have photos of the demonstrations and protesters in London on our Instagram feed. Follow us there at PRI The World. 8 endangered rhinos die in Kenya. The full story behind that headline, that's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Kenya has become a leader when it comes to taking care of its wildlife. Really encouraging to see when I was there, especially the orphan sanctuary for baby elephants. So news this week of the deaths of 8 critically endangered black rhinos is shocking. That amounts to 1% of Kenya's total black rhino population. Here's Paula Kahumbu of the conservation group Wildlife Direct.
Losing 8 black rhinos in Kenya in the period of less than a week is very serious. We see this as a national disaster. This is decades of conservation effort gone in just the matter of a few days.
Kathy Dean is the director of Save the Rhino International. She joins us now from London. So, Kathy, 14 black rhinos total were moved, and 8 of them died. Do we know why this happened?
Well, just to amend one thing, the original plan was to move 14 animals. After animals started dying, further translocations were halted. So, in fact, only 11 rhinos were actually moved. But 8 out of 11 is a terrible record. Early indications are that 2 of the animals died due to complications during the translocation itself. But the other 6, the prevailing theory at the moment is that they died of salt poisoning. We all know that after we've eaten salty food, you feel thirsty. So if they kept on drinking more and more water to try to get rid of the salty taste, it could have built up an overload in their systems. But until the postmortems have been done, it's honestly not possible to say for definite.
Are rhinos particularly susceptible to salt poisoning?
I've never heard of it before, to be honest. This is a new one to me. I've been at Save the Rhino for 17 years, and I honestly can't remember anything like this. Again, there's fairly basic questions about the translocation we need answers to before we can come to any conclusions.
Why were the rhinos being relocated in the first place? And is relocating rhinos or any endangered species always going to be risky?
Anytime you anaesthetize an animal, there is a risk. They might have an underlying heart condition that only becomes known once you've applied a sedative of some sort. But nonetheless, that's worth doing. If one park, for example, becomes overcrowded, you will find that breeding performance drops right off. They need space, they need water, they need enough vegetation to eat. You also want to mix rhinos up for genetic diversity reasons. You've got to have 20 unrelated animals to have a genetically viable population. So the decision to move additional animals in was probably correct. The big question is, was it done to the best possible procedures and protocols?
So these 8 deaths of these black rhinos, as I said, that represents 1% of Kenya's total black rhino numbers. What's going to be the impact on the total population? Can the numbers recover?
They will, but rhinos breed slowly. You know, even in the best conditions, it's one calf. They never have twins or triplets, or my job would be a lot easier. One calf every 2.5 to 3 years. So it takes a long time. For each of those animals lost, and particularly the females, you've lost further breeding opportunities.
Back in March, the world's last male northern white rhino was put down, also in Kenya. It's kind of been a tough year for rhinos.
It's not been good, but there have been successes as well. Kenya's got a pretty good track record. Several of the field programs we work at have had 0 poaching for 3 years now, which is a fantastic record. You know, there is good community engagement. Actually, the outpouring of anguish from the Kenyan public that I see on Twitter and Facebook, people do feel a sense of pride and ownership in their rhinos, and they're angry about these deaths. So, yeah, this is a setback, but it mustn't result in the world losing confidence in Kenya having an important part to play in preserving our black rhinos.
Kathy Dean is the director of Save the Rhino International. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
A lot of times we can feel powerless when we hear faraway stories about nature or the environment. But here's something we all have power over, our toothbrushes. And 1 billion plastic toothbrushes are thrown out every year. That's billion with a B. That's just in the U.S. Here in our newsroom, we recently received a toothbrush in the mail. It's made of bamboo, and on it is written, "One less plastic toothbrush in our oceans." It also came with a CD. The CD is called Small Island, Big Song. The musicians are from islands in the Pacific and Indian Oceans under threat from climate change. Here's musician Elena Marang from Borneo.
I play the sape, which is a lute instrument, which was traditionally played only by men. And many people in my generation didn't play until about 4 years ago. So the song that we're sharing with you is called Pumbong Jae, which is in the Kenya language. It's a song about being together with my true friends by the river under the moonlight. It's a very simple song with simple lyrics. Layered over it, some of the elder women playing the pagang. The pagang is a bamboo instrument with 4 strings carved out of it, and not many people play it anymore. It was really nice to see us recording the pagang because for me it's important for the younger people in the village to see that these instruments still have a value and they're valued by people.
black land, a land.
My name is Yoyo Tuki, and I'm from the island of Rapa Nui, which is Easter Island, and it's actually one of the most isolated places on the planet. So it's 4,000 kilometers from Tahiti and 3,700 kilometers from South America, from Chile. And it's a Polynesian island. We are very familiar and very connected with the people from Hawaii, from New Zealand, from Tahiti. And for Small Islandic Song, I've been offering the song Kava Ai Mai Koi.
Kava Ai Mai Koi Touri Mae Na.
It's a song about community. It's about being together. Coming from a small island, you know, imagine that the people are very close, they're very connected. And it's very important to get along, to, you know, find a way to work things out. Because you have nowhere to go, you know, you have nowhere to run. So, yeah, thank you so much, and it's been a beautiful journey, and Maururu.
That singer, Yoyo Tuki from Easter Island. This music was recorded for the Small Island Big Song Project. It's a CD and film tackling the impacts of climate change on islands in the Pacific and Indian Oceans. To learn more about this, head on over to our Facebook page. I'm Marco Werman. When Presidents Trump and Putin meet on Monday, the stakes will be high. Sort of like they were in 1961 when Kennedy met Khrushchev.
Kennedy learned a hard lesson, and the world learned a hard lesson, because the acrimony that came out of that meeting contributed to the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is the closest we've come to nuclear war.
That story ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. I was watching that press conference between British Prime Minister Theresa May and President Donald Trump in the UK earlier today, and I couldn't take my eyes off it. After slamming Theresa May in an interview with the Sun newspaper the night before, Trump was forced to make nice.
I have gotten to know Theresa May much better over the last 2 days than I've known her over the last year and a half. I mean, we've spent more time in the last 2 days. Yesterday I had breakfast, lunch, and dinner with her. Then I said, what are we doing tomorrow, which is today? Oh, you're having breakfast and lunch with Theresa May. And I'm going to see you later on again. So, but I've actually gotten to know her better than ever. And I think she's a terrific woman. I think she's doing a terrific job. And that Brexit is a very tough situation.
Yes, tough indeed. And that presser, kind of a field day for satirists.
For satirists, it's like shooting fish in a barrel.
Carol Hills, so many opportunities. Where do the cartoonists, like, even stop?
Well, I think that's what's sort of a central issue. I mean, I love satire, and I think it's really an important way to look at how people around the world are thinking about things as opposed to what they say. And Trump provides this just bottomless pit of material. But there's also a part of me that, though I revel in it, and lots of people do, and the web has really provided this vehicle that I think has really given much wider audience for satire, encouraged people to engage in satire, political satire, you know, you just kind of consume it and move on. And people are consuming in their own bubbles, including me. And so you wonder, when all is said and done, if satire has as much impact, because it's simply going to the people who already believe it. There's no metaphorical campfire that everybody's sitting around and listening to. So I have mixed feelings about the whole thing.
It's weird because the same things that Trump says that satires pick up on and, by the way, sell papers with totally appeal to his base. Anyway, we've been hearing so many things about, you know, like the baby Trump limp at the London protests. And from there, it almost seems like the satire is too easy. Is there one bit of lampooning, though, that you've come across and you thought, huh, that was funny and it made me think?
There was one before I came in here. I just saw it. And it's this cartoon by an Australian, Peter Brolman. It shows a statue of Churchill. The caption's based on a famous speech he made after France was defeated by the Nazis. His famous speech was about keeping Britain focused on defeating Hitler and not giving in. We shall fight them on the beaches. We shall never surrender. That whole thing. And
you do Churchill really well, by the way.
I don't have a cigar, though. And so Trump is in front of the statue. What the cartoon caption says is, we shall mock him on the beaches. And he's sort of pointing at Trump, the statue. And that says more than simple satire. It's kind of saying to this satirist, no matter what Trump tries to do, no matter how statesmanlike he tries to be, it's just not flying. There's something about his manner, his informality, his unfilteredness that is never going to cut it in certain circles. Again, that doesn't matter to a lot of people who support Trump. But there is something, I find something poignant in that.
Yeah, and well worth noting, too, that Trump admires Churchill. There was also the recent NATO summit, a disaster or success, depending on whom you speak with or when you happen to hear Trump talk about it. What did you see there, like themes from that NATO summit?
Well, a really great one was a cartoon. It was a takeoff on Tank Man from Tiananmen Square, where he's standing in front of the tank. And in this case, Trump is driving the tank and Merkel is in front of the tank with her arms up, you know, just kind of going, stop.
Right. Well, that's powerful.
Very powerful. And then there's a lot just of the sense that Trump, it's sort of with friends like these kind of things,
right.
You know, him kind of mowing down his allies, or they're in a line waiting to shake his hand and he just kind of extends his hand, but he's passing them and he's going to shake a hand with Putin instead.
The NATO themes, of course, also tie into Trump's upcoming meeting with Putin in Helsinki on Monday. What have you seen on that?
Well, there's a great cartoon by this very irreverent cartoonist named Marian Kamensky. He is Croatian-born but has lived in Austria for a while, and he's just sometimes I can't post this stuff. They're just, you know.
Too out there.
So anyway, this one, it's called Dirty Dancing in Helsinki, and Putin and Trump have their shirts off, and they're doing the Russian folk dance, you know, hands on the hips and kicking out the legs, and they're doing it over a flag of NATO. And around them are empty and half-empty bottles of what looked like vodka. But if you look closely, the label is Novichok. Of course, it's a reference to the Novichok and the poisoning in England, the second one and the woman dying. But it also happens to be, whether the cartoonist knows or not, some Russian beer company has offered this Novichok beer label. So there's a Novichok beer out there. So
it doesn't contain Novichok. It's just a trolling idea.
Just a trolling idea. There is no end to satire about Trump, wherever you are along the political spectrum.
Yeah, so what's your takeaway on all this? What's your deep thought on the funny stuff?
That it's really funny, but I don't know, in this era of a complete divide and a complete absence of any kind of dialogue across political differences, that is doing anything. Well, I'm not sure it's meant to do anything, but there's just some sense that it's like, oh, and then we all go on. I mean, I'm not sure what's to be done, but there is this, it's just a funny time for satire when you have a country and I think a world so divided, literally, and then technology completely aiding and abetting in that division.
The World's Carol Hills. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Marco.
By the way, if you want to see some of the cartoons Carol talked about, just go to PRI.org. Monday's summit in Helsinki between Trump and Russia's Vladimir Putin definitely has echoes of summits in the Cold War era. Back then, U.S. presidents met their Soviet counterparts in cities all across Europe, and just like today, the stakes were high. One particular summit that took place more than 50 years ago comes to mind.
Premier Khrushchev arrives in Vienna for the first summit meeting with a U.S. president since the ill-starred conference with President Eisenhower in Paris. President Kennedy is next on the scene as he flies in from Paris.
University of Texas at Austin history professor Jeremy Suri joins us. So, Jeremy, the 1961 Kennedy-Khrushchev summit took place in Vienna. Just give us a historical context that was leading up to this summit.
We had a new president, a new exciting president in John F. Kennedy, and we had Nikita Khrushchev, who had been the leader of the Soviet Union since the death of Stalin or soon thereafter. And these two men came together in Vienna in June of 1961, and there was a lot of hope that this would open a new moment of peaceful relations in the Cold War, and that a lot of areas of conflict, like Berlin, would be solved at this moment.
Who set up the meeting in the first place?
The meeting was actually called for by the Soviets. They had begun a series of efforts to work out an agreement to end what they believed was the unfair American and Western occupation of West Berlin. And Khrushchev had come to the United States and met with Dwight Eisenhower, and Eisenhower had met with Khrushchev in 1960. So this was the next in that series of meetings, but this time with a new president, John F. Kennedy.
And why the Austrian capital?
Well, Austria was one of the neutral states at the end of World War II. It was one of the states that was divided, actually, as Germany was. Austria had been reunited in 1955, but Vienna still served a role similar to what Geneva does today, as a kind of neutral spot where antagonists could meet.
So we reported yesterday on the program that Trump will be meeting with Putin one-on-one in Helsinki. That's kind of in the early stages of that summit. This was also the case with Kennedy and Khrushchev, I gather, a one-on-one meeting. And it apparently was a priority for Kennedy. Why was that?
Well, Kennedy believed that one of the problems surrounding U.S.-Soviet relations was that an old series of experts, people who had been trained by John Foster Dulles and Dean Acheson, were dominating American political decision-making. And he promised he'd bring a new frontier, a new personal energy to relations with the Soviets. So he wanted to be able to sit down with Khrushchev. And quite frankly, Kennedy thought he could charm Khrushchev as he charmed so many others.
And what do we know about what happened in that one-on-one?
It was a disaster. An absolute disaster for three reasons that are very relevant when we think about these meetings today also. First, Khrushchev was so much better prepared than Kennedy. Second, charm that works domestically perhaps doesn't work in an international setting. And third, America's allies were horrified. Here was a new president coming into this meeting, not consulting with them as deeply as they wanted, acting in ways that revealed how unprepared he was. Kennedy himself, at the end of the meeting, admitted that he had made a big mistake.
Yeah, the quote was, "Khrushchev just beat the hell out of me." I mean, he copped to that.
Absolutely. Kennedy learned a hard lesson, and the world learned a hard lesson because the acrimony that came out of that meeting contributed to the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is the closest we've come to nuclear war. So it's a really scary outcome.
There's a line in your foreign policy story about the Kennedy-Khrushchev summit in Vienna that seems to be relevant today, and that is, U.S. economic and military superiority is indeed a liability when the president enters one-on-one negotiations with an adversary powerful enough to resist Washington and also weak enough to claim victimhood. So I read that and I wonder, like, even if Trump were briefed to the hilt and was super prepared, does that reality suggest that Putin will emerge on top come what may?
I think Russian President Vladimir Putin has all the advantages in meeting with President Trump. Putin has far more experience and much more knowledge, and he can claim victimhood in a way that the United States cannot. Putin's entire argument is that the West at the end of the Cold War has taken advantage of the former Soviet Union, now Russia, and that we should back down and give Russia more opportunity in places like Ukraine and elsewhere to flex its muscles and build its economy. And that's a self-serving argument, but it's a difficult argument to respond to when you're the United States and you've been at war in Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya, and you're threatening to go to war in North Korea and Iran. When you're the big gorilla, it's very hard to shake the sense that you're the bully. And when you're bullying other countries, it's hard to get them to make agreements that you want them to make.
Jerry, taking all that into consideration, put yourself in the shoes of one of Trump's advisors on Monday. What would you tell him before his meeting with Putin?
Wow, I have a long list of things I would tell him. The first is I would tell him it's a very bad idea to go into his meeting with Putin without any other Americans around him. Second, I would tell him that the most important thing he could do is to size up what Russia's positions are without making any claims about some great agreement or any hope for any breakthrough. These breakthroughs never happen in a first meeting or even a second meeting. Trump has to see this as the first of many meetings.
Jeremy Suri is a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You know, it's easy to forget today, what with all the news about Russian intelligence officers being indicted in Washington, and just as President Trump gets ready for a summit with Putin on Monday, that there's still the Men's World Cup going on in Russia right now. After a full month of competition, the tournament will come to a close on Sunday, with France and Croatia facing off in the final. FIFA, soccer's governing body, today went ahead and declared the tournament a huge success. FIFA President Gianni Infantino even claimed the World Cup had improved Russia's image around the globe. Charles Maines joins us from Moscow. So I got to say, there's a temptation to compare Russia's hosting the 2018 World Cup to the Sochi Olympics in 2014. Both events put Russia on the world stage in the spotlight and had the potential to burnish Russia and Putin internationally. Where do the two events part ways when you compare them, though?
Well, I mean, first of all, Sochi was one city. You could kind of create this mirage for the Olympic Games around the city of Sochi, but whereas Russia hosted now in 11 cities across the country. So in a way, it was Russia very much opening itself up in a way that they weren't able to during Sochi. I think it is interesting, though, that having been to the Sochi Games and now to the World Cup here, the atmosphere has this almost ideal version of Russia. Everyone's a little friendlier, you know, people helping each other on the street. The cops are friendly, which is unheard of. And it just seems to show this idea that Russia can have this slightly more liberal environment. Nothing bad will happen. And they can also be open to the world, which is something we haven't seen much of over these last several years.
Is there an expectation that after the Croatia-France game on Sunday, cops will go back to being unfriendly and people go back to their old ways?
I think there is. I mean, I think that people were hoping very much so that the sort of the street parties we've seen over the last month will continue. But, you know, frankly, there was a sense that once the cities began to belong to people again, you know, you could wander around at night, drink on the street, drink beer, people would have fun. And, you know, looking at these crowds all the time, you would always look and think, well, if you were not holding an Uruguay scarf, but instead a poster that denounced Putin, that's just unfathomable in this country under normal circumstances.
I mean, the Russian team actually did better than expected, aside from what the team was able to achieve on the field. How did Russians feel about hosting the World Cup?
They felt great about it. And that's the thing. I mean, I think for Russians who have heard for so long that the world hates them from their own state media, it was really in some ways kind of jarring to see this warm welcome from foreigners who were so excited to be here. Now, in another way, I think also for foreigners, they came here and they said, look, we've heard so many bad things about Russia, and look, what a wonderful reception we've gotten. Just talking to people on the street, and both from Russia and from abroad, you know, everyone felt really good about these games. And in terms of the Russian team, you know, it was this swell of kind of genuine patriotism, I think in a positive sense of the word, whereas in Russia, so often, it feels sometimes like these patriotic moods are manufactured in some way. And this was a genuine pride, I think, in the Russian performance, not because they're such a great team, but using, you know, the skills that they had and the skill sets that they offered, they managed to go toe-to-toe with some of the great soccer powers and indeed see some of the best players in the world pack up and go home before the Russian squad had to.
The World's Charles Maines in Moscow. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
Helsinki, Finland. What do you think of? Reindeer? Nokia cell phones? Political summits between East and West? When Presidents Trump and Putin meet in Helsinki on Monday, it'll hardly be the first U.S.-Russia summit there. To understand the significance of this small, far-flung venue, we've got Kavita Pillay in the studio with us. She's a documentary producer and reporter, and she's spent a lot of time in Finland. In fact, she's produced a radio documentary about the place, set to air on the BBC World Service next month. Hi, Kavita.
Hi, Marco.
So help me understand this. We know there have been summits in Helsinki in the past, but help us understand why, when Putin has made his expansionist attitudes well-known and Trump has made his entire personality well-known, why Finland would kind of abet these two leaders by loaning out their reputation and brand to these two men on their territory?
So Finns do kind of have a feeling that they are referees. They've kind of served as referees before. I was just reading today that some brewery in Helsinki came up with a beer called Let's Settle This Like Adults. They came up with it in time for the summit, and it features Trump and Putin on it. They kind of feel like they are this middle ground. You know, Finland has this historic kind of element of being a place where West and East really intersect.
So for your upcoming documentary, you've got some Finns talking about their country metaphorically as if it's a house. Let's listen to that.
On the other side of the street, we have Sweden, perhaps a bit more colorful.
We would have kind of like same kind of house as Finland does, but a little prettier and a little bigger.
Russia would be already more like monolithic and maybe perhaps darker colors.
Russia sometimes even comes in without knocking. That's just their personality. They just come and they yell at you. But then the Finnish neighbor, they're going to think about it for 5 days, whereas the Russian neighbor has already forgotten about it. And then they might invite you in the evening for tea.
So Russia might storm into the house and yell at you, but then eventually they'd invite you over for tea.
That's kind of, you know, Finland has this huge border with Russia. So they have this unusual relationship with Russia. It's both the Goliath next door, but they have to play nice with them. They have to figure out a way to maintain that border and still be very much a part of the Nordic nations.
Right. So coming back to that idea of let's settle this like adults, I mean, they take a very practical approach, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Finland's reputation for not standing up to an opposing power is so strong it even spawned the term Finlandization. Talk a bit about what that means.
Right. So Finlandization is this Cold War term. It's not a compliment. It means you're a small country and that you occasionally bow down to or appease a much larger neighbor. At the very least, you don't oppose them.
Mm.
And that's what Finland did during the Cold War. You know, they managed to stay independent. So for Finns, maintaining that border is really about being pragmatic.
I mean, one of the people you spoke with in Finland goes so far as to describe Finland's behavior vis-a-vis Russia as Stockholm Syndrome,
mm-hmm.
you know, expressing warm feelings for somebody's captor.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what he says.
Then in the 70s and 80s, we started to like the captor, what is called the Stockholm Syndrome. And we started to explain to ourselves that it's better this way. It's better to understand the Soviet Union in every aspect. The Journalist Association, 1974, gave a declaration saying that we Finnish journalists, we want to serve the mutual friendship. And that was the height of self-censorship.
So that was writer and historian Lasse Lehtinen. Kavita, post-Cold War, is Finland any less Finlandized?
Well, certainly Finland is a very different place. The neighborhood is a very different place. There's no Soviet Union. Finland is now a full member of the EU. It's not a member of NATO, but it has strong ties to NATO. And the Finnish media regularly criticizes Putin in a way that they wouldn't have criticized the USSR back in the day. And sometimes you do hear about Finnish politicians who are a little soft on Russia, and then people will ask, are we being re-Finlandized? Is Finlandization creeping back in?
So we've been talking about Finland's relationship with Russia, but we should point out that Finland's also defined by its other neighbor to the west, Sweden.
Right. Finland was part of the Swedish Empire for 700 years. So that is really the biggest influence on Finland and Finnish culture. But Finland has this kind of this little sibling syndrome with Sweden. They kind of look at Sweden as, oh, the sister who got it better, right? But there is also kind of a darker grudge because basically Finland was Sweden's shield against Russia.
Huh.
For so long.
So Finland, an awkwardly situated country with a suffocating relationship with Russia, and yet we hear these great things about Finland on all kinds of fronts and their success in education. Tell us about that.
Yeah. You know, when I went there, I was interested in how has this kind of scrappy underdog been shaped by its two much bigger, more powerful neighbors. And I kind of ultimately came to the conclusion that it's kind of not despite those neighbors, but because of them that Finland looked inward, invested heavily in its population. And now, you know, it's always at the top of these global rankings, like best governed, most democratic, most press freedom,
right.
Happiest. It's happiest. Now the happiest country in the world, despite their reputation for melancholy.
So I want to play just one more clip from your documentary, Kavita, which kind of sums up the success of Finland, but with a twist. This is comedian Stan Sanila.
The leaps we've taken in the last 100 years have been enormous. We've built this country together, and we'll stay here for as long as we can until the Russians come.
The Russians are coming. The Russians are coming. Well, it sounds like some people at least have a sense of humor about Russian relations. Kavita Pillay is a documentary producer and reporter. Her radio doc on Finland is scheduled to air on the BBC World Service next month. Kavita, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dogs in your hills.
And we leave you in Finland today with a track that, well, doesn't really evoke anything about the country except for the voice singing it. For the past few weeks, 25-year-old pop star Sani has been in Finland's top 10 with her hit Jacuzzi. Notice the song isn't called Sauna. Also notice Sani has all the hallmarks of Jamaican dancehall, and she auto-tunes her voice around lyrics that recall a vacation to Sicily and drinking bubbly, while some guy raps in Italian, "Excuse me, welcome to my jacuzzi." Yeah, totally Finnish. Next up, Helsinki. We'll take you back there Monday on the show. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. Our theme music, No Auto-Tune, was composed by Eric Goldberg. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.